Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and we're doing something a little bit different this week. There is no sponsor for this week's show, and I actually did two different feature interviews this week that didn't quite pan out for various reasons. So you know what? This week's episode is just going to be a chat between me and Adam Boileau, who is back after a three-week absence. We'll be covering the week's InfoSec news and then taking a look at SWIFT. SWIFT, of course, is the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication. SWIFT is the way money gets sent around the globe by the banks. It is back in the headlines at the moment due to some research out of BAE that found a recent attack against the Bangladesh Central Bank that saw thieves abscond with around $100 million made use of custom malware that interfered with the SWIFT software. We've also seen some reporting that there have been several attacks against SWIFT infrastructure thanks to a leaked memo out of SWIFT itself. More on that later. But what are the security issues around SWIFT? Well, they are many, and Adam and I will talk about that a little bit later on. But right now, we're going to get into the news with Adam Boileau. And first of all, Adam, welcome back. I hope you had a nice break.
Yeah, I had a great time. Went to a couple of good conferences in Canberra, hung out with some spooks and some govs and, a few good old-fashioned hackers as well. But, it's good to get out, away from the deck for a little while and see some nature and some trees and not talk about hacking for, a week. But here we are, and we've got a lot of hacking to talk about.
Well, I know that one of the places you went to see nature and trees was actually at Snare's Coastal Lair, so that doesn't count as not talking about hacking and stuff and just spending time with the trees.
I guess we did talk about computers this afternoon.
I'm guessing you would have. Anyway, let's get into it. James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence in the United States, has given us some interesting info. You and I have often wondered what the actual impact of the Snowden leaks has been. It turns out the US intelligence community has modeled the impact and can tell us very clearly in no uncertain terms that he has brought forward encryption rollouts by 7 years. It's just really interesting to get a nice solid number like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good to have metrics, I guess, to see how well we've succeeded. And of course, I think the main aspect that we saw as a result of the Snowden thing that had really accelerated was the much more widespread use of TLS for web traffic, but also for mail transfer. I mean, Google pushing ahead with SMTP TLS, I imagine, really killed quite a lot of their passive collect. I mean, email is a massive part of their tool chain. It's the original part of their tool chain. And we saw from the Snowden docs how important email targeting and email selectors were to them. So having the SMTP encrypted on the wire by all of the big, mail providers, was certainly a really big step. And I imagine that's a very large part of the 7 year number. But of course, the rest of the things that are helping, Let's Encrypt, things that are going to encourage adoption of TLS. I think that is the bulk of it. Of course, instant messaging and other things we've seen in the last few months. But yeah, 7 years is a reasonable number. I think, Ed Snowden can probably, sleep well at night knowing that he did that. And seeing the James Clapper actually say that, that's quite pleasant. I suppose he must be quite pleased about that.
Yeah, well, I'm in Brazil at the moment, a country of 200 million people, and they all use WhatsApp because SMS is so unreliable here, And now that is all end-to-end encrypted. And, James Clapper said, well, it's not good for us. And, honestly, it isn't. Speaking of messaging encryption, Viber has actually rolled out encryption to its 711 million users. And it's funny when you talk about the scale of these things, because when I first read this headline and saw that they had 711 million users, I just thought, oh, is that all?
Yeah, well, it does. I guess it does. It sets the scene for quite how big mobile comms is these days. Billions and billions of devices, or billions of people using billions and billions of devices. But 700 million—that's a lot of people to, as they say in the parlance these days, go dark.
The parlance of our time.
In the parlance of our times,
Yeah. Of course, the interesting thing about Viber, I guess, and one of the things that the Kaspersky Threat Post articles in the News List mentions is that they are, of course, not an American company. They're owned by a Japanese conglomerate. They run out of Israel. And the article takes quite a lot of pleasure in pointing out the US Senate won't actually be able to to do anything about that.
Well, aside from block it from the app stores, but, you know, we're a long way from that sort of legislation coming to fruition. But, you know, why would they want to encrypt? The question might be, why would Viber and WhatsApp and all of these organizations want to encrypt? Well, here is a good reason. The UK intelligence agencies, you know, particularly the GCHQ, you know, throughout the whole Snowden disclosure period over the last few years, we've often remarked that the GCHQ was the worst offender in terms of violating people's privacy. And there's yet more evidence courtesy of Privacy International that shows us like just how much they didn't give a shit about people's privacy.
Yeah, no, there's some documentation that they've been referring to which describes the controls around access to a particular set of bulk data repositories they have, and the sort of level of control you know, that people had to submit through to be able to use that data. You know, basically saying why you're querying the data with like a, you know, free text field that no one is ever going to use for anything because it contains rubbish, badly formed data. And then also there were some questions that they had asked regarding the number of prosecutions or the number of disciplinary actions that had been taken in the result of people not complying with the policies. And those numbers were essentially trivial from June 2014 till 2016. No one had been dismissed as a result of using that data creepily, which, let's face it, there's people, there's humans involved. There will be some people creeping with that data set. And then at the SIS and the MI5, a total of 5 people subject to disciplinary procedures, and no one at the GCHQ, which really does suggest that your oversight's not working exactly. Particularly well.
Your oversight is rubbish, you know, and it's just funny because, like, they've got, you know, data sets on so many people who aren't suspected of doing a single thing, like... GCHQ really knows how to turn up the creepy factor, and this is just more evidence of that.
Well, especially when they're, you know, when they're creeping on, you know, people posting fake bits of Harry Potter, you know, unpublished Harry Potter books on the internet.
Investigating that. I think that too much hay was made of that. I think it was probably just some analyst, you know, at GCHQ who saw it in an IRC channel or something and said, "Hey, I'm a Harry Potter fan. Let's ring J.K. Rowling." You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it was some. Yeah. I don't think it was some huge like GCHQ mandate to protect the economy of the UK, like some journalists are saying.
No, I agree. I think it probably is fanboyism.
Yeah.
virtue of, you know, being able to phone up and say, "Hi, I'm from the government and we're here to help."
Now, apparently, according to comments by FBI Director James Comey, the FBI will have did pay. Okay, this is we've got to be careful the way they say this, because the headlines say the FBI paid at least $1.3 million for the unlock of Farouk's, you know, San Bernardino iPhone. But when you look at the way they arrived at this figure, it's like James Comey was kind of roundabout in the way that he described the amount. He said it was more money than he was going to earn in the rest of his term at the FBI. So, and people have calculated from that it's about $1.3 million. So there you go. But it doesn't exactly seem like a cold, hard, firm number, does it?
Well, it seems like the opposite of a cold, hard, firm number. I mean, I guess it sets a lower bound, you know, assuming that he wasn't being completely flippant about it and that he will not, you know, retire next week or something. I guess the important thing is, A, they paid some money for the bug, B, the bug worked, which, you know, is important, I suppose, and C, that it's clearly quite a bit of money, which I don't think we're at all surprised about. Obviously, the details will come out eventually as to exactly how much money, I mean, or at least that's the way that some transparency in government's meant to work, right? But yeah, some, you know, I guess $1.5 million doesn't seem super unreasonable. I mean, a bug that costs $100,000 plus, you know, the markup for when you're selling it to governments and project management costs. Yeah, I'm like, that doesn't seem an unreasonable amount of money.
Well, I mean, it's you could charge them anything, and, you know, anything that's seven figures is anything simply because they needed it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you've got what can get you out of this awful situation. How about $1.5 million? And they'd say, sure, here you go. We'll write you a check.
Yeah.
The funny thing is,
it's got to be cheaper than the lawyers.
The usual people jumping up and down saying that, you know, the FBI needs to disclose the technique. And the FBI has come back and said, well, it's not our technique, so we can't disclose it. Which seems like a reasonable position.
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily a reasonable position. I certainly understand the rationale. They don't want to blow the technique they spent $1 million on. And obviously it's got a bunch of other use, you know, around the government and in the FBI. But on the other hand, like, not disclosing the techniques that they use when they are critical to the process of prosecuting it, like we saw with the stingrays and the, you know, the way they've been not disclosing their investigative techniques there. So, you know, I'm not sure I entirely buy the "we don't have to tell you because secrets," but clearly in this case, they're going to try and keep it secret for as long as they can, at least until they're forced to disclose it.
Yeah, but everyone's jumping up and down going, "Whoa, O'Day, we're really like the technique that it was outlined to me used bugs that were actually publicized by Project Zero. So do you know what I mean? I just think, I don't know. It just seems all a bit weird. And all of these people jumping up and down saying, oh, it'll be in the hands of criminals. I'm like, who are these criminals with chip sockets for iPhone NANs who are just running around desperate to get really complicated unlock techniques so that they can rebirth iPhones? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. But anyway, I'm not going to pick another fight with Segoyan on my podcast. I do enough of that on Twitter.
I think the root here is that for a lot of people, O'Day is a rare and wonderful sparkly unicorn that shows up once in 100 years. Whereas the reality when you work in the bug hunting industry is that O'Day is every day. Right, it's just different O'Day. People, I think, get worked up when they don't see it very often. For the rest of us, it's like, well, it's just another bug, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I've resisted it as long as I could, Adam, but I'm going to have to say the word cyberbomb. Because the US military, and this is a couple of weeks ago now, the US military, I think it was Fox News first reported on it, which is the type of outlet you'd expect to use the term cyberbomb. But some general or whatever from the US military is, he's talking about using the cyberbombs on the ISIS.
Yes, in fact, it's not just the general, it's the Deputy Secretary of Defense. His name's Robert O. Work. He's been saying
really?
That they are going to quote, he says, quote, we are dropping cyberbombs. And quote, we have never done that before. Well, I guess he means the military haven't specifically done it. Obviously, the NSA has got their fair share of cyber bombs up their cyber sleeves. I guess what they're trying to say is that they are going to go hack some ISIS stuff. And, by talking about it publicly, they sow, sort of discord and fear and certainly doubt, I suppose, in the minds of ISIS people who are using whatever comms mechanisms because they can't trust that they're getting the real thing. So, it's kind of classic psyops rather than necessarily cyberops.
Well, not necessarily because, the NSA, right, the NSA's their primary goal is collection, right? And I know they do some of the warfighting shit, but what seems to be happening now is that the military operators are infiltrating comms and they're saying, you get a text from your colonel when you're an ISIS fighter saying, hey, can you meet me in this open field at noon tomorrow? Right? Yeah. You drive along, you get out of your car. Yeah, you're standing there and you're going, huh, I'm in the field. And then one of your other mates turns up and, hey, the colonel told us to meet him here. What's going on? Where's the colonel? And then, kablam, drone strike, right? Yeah. So it seems like they're just mixing it up a little bit, and it looks like the military is getting involved in a space that typically has belonged to the NSA. So, as much as we can laugh about the term of cyber bombs, I think what they're saying is that they're actually, they're real cyber actual bombs that are blowing things up, right? So that it's kind of interesting to see an evolution of the use of SIGINT in warfighting. But moving on to some more traditional, SIGINT cybering. I hate that word, but we have to use it. It's 2016. We have to. There's a really interesting APT crew called Platinum rolling with some pretty awesome techniques. Looks like they're attacking a bunch of people in Southeast Asia. And, we spoke about this before we started recording the news, and you think this is probably a Singaporean campaign.
Yeah, so Microsoft have got this write-up of this group Platinum, and one of the aspects, other than the technical thing, of course, is the targeting. And this group's been operating something since about 2009 using infrastructure that they can kind of tie together and techniques they can tie together into one crew. And of their target base, it's 40-something% Malaysian government, 30-something% Indonesian government, some Indian. And, of course, that mix, you sort of turn around and go, well, it's probably the Singaporeans. I don't know. Mm. But, all of the targets are in Southeast Asia. Some of the techniques they're using, and there's quite a lot of O'Day. There's some they've been using some of the Windows infrastructure for, hot patching things rather than using standard process injection, which is quite a cool way to avoid some of the, sort of behavioral-based monitoring, heuristic monitoring kind of things you might see in NAV.
Well, funnily enough, this is a technique that was presented in 2013 by Alex Ionescu at SciScan in Singapore. So I've just got this picture of this. I've got a picture of some guy from the Singapore SIGINT agency just sitting there going, interesting idea.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Alex Sotarov, I think, presented on that in Black Hat 10 years ago, something like that now. So, I mean, the technique was certainly Well, it had been discussed in the open literature. I don't know how well used it was prior to this, but certainly it seems I've never seen a write-up of it being used in the wild before. But yeah, that's another sign that does kind of point vaguely towards Singapore, which is pretty funny. Right? But yeah, I mean, the Microsoft write-up itself is actually quite good. I mean, unsurprisingly, Microsoft does do good work, I suppose. It has a bunch of indicators of compromise, things you might want to go look at. If you're a listener in government in Southeast Asia, you might want to go check some of those hashes against the rest of your network and see how badly you've been owned by this particular crew. But yeah, it really does look like state-sponsored, you know, intelligence-focused against government, long-term APT, which is, you know, surprising to no one. I mean, SIGINT is going to SIGINT.
Who runs SciScan?
That would be Mr. Thomas Lin.
Hmm.
Good friend of mine, keynoted KiwiCon a few years back. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't need to go there. we've got a report here from The Guardian on people using stolen Uber creds to like go on awesome rides around awesome places. My favorite one is the person who used stolen credentials, loaded it up into Uber on a throwaway phone or whatever, and used it to Uber around the circumference of Manhattan, being dropped off precisely where they were picked up. It was a nice little sightseeing journey.
Probably, took a lady friend for a nice ride, drank some champagne in the back of the very expensive Uber X, I'm sure. Mm. Yeah, it does seem like this is a problem for a number of people who are using Uber. Although, of course, there's no suggestion immediately that Uber itself has been breached. I mean, kind of the scale is more likely to be bad passwords or creative reuse across multiple sites.
Yeah, or phishing or whatever. But isn't it cool that people are actually doing this? Like, I just think it's hilarious that I can imagine some 16-year-old kid going, oh, man, I got some Uber creds. Like, you know, let's go to Mexico.
I'm taking this thing to Mexico.
Yeah, I guess it is a low value, high lols sort of crime exactly. Compared to the multi-billion dollars worth of bank fraud we'll talk about a bit later on.
A nuclear plant in Germany, its fuel rod system is swarming with malware, and not just any malware, like vintage classic retro malware, which is just like, guys, I mean, they're not connected to the internet, which makes you go, oh, thank God. But if they're not connected to the internet, how'd the fucking malware get on the systems in the first place?
I guess I would like to imagine that there's some hipster with his tweed suit and very nicely coiffed beard and good haircut, sitting there, ironically using the XP box to manage the plant's fuel rod system with Conficker, and has ironically infected it with Conficker and a bunch of other remote access Trojans, via USB stick, specifically for, sort of hipster ironic purposes. Sadly, of course, that's not actually the case.
But you just know it was some stick with a USB drive with Game of Thrones on it, right? You just know that's how it got there.
Apparently, they found 18 infected USB storage devices at this particular nuclear plant. So, of course, surprising absolutely no one that it had Conficker and a bunch of other things as well. I guess we should be glad that it didn't have Stuxnet or anything that does actually command and control across air gaps.
Yeah, I really hope these ISIS guys don't start a cyber university or something.
I know, right? We are so lucky that they don't actually understand how to do this stuff yet.
We're not ready. Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, now Dan Gooden was on Twitter the other day, and I noticed he was tweeting around. Dan Gooden, the journalist at Ars Technica, very fine information security journalist, Dan, who's been around for a long time. And he was tweeting around saying, has anyone got any examples of Android actually being hosed by drive-by downloads? Because, you always hear of Privask and rogue apps and all this sort of stuff. But has anyone heard of that? Well, apparently his investigations turned up something, because Ars Technica is carrying a story looking at the first ever drive-by exploits affecting Android, which is interesting. And you'd say this is a bit of a watershed moment in Android's history. Like it's finally that depressing moment where, yes, Android is getting hosed by actual drive-by vulns.
Yeah, there was some research, I guess, that Dan dug up, which I think was a combination of work from Bluecoat and Zimperium, where they found examples of some drive-by-download malware being served by advertising on porn websites that was capable of hosing pretty much all of the Android 4 releases up to and including 4.4. and would, you know, gain root access on the device through a combination of bugs. Some of them are actually based on the ones from the Hacking Team breach, which, like, you know, I guess does, you know, I guess the Hacking Team guys must at least take some, you know, some solace in the fact that their bugs are now at least being well used. And clearly they were good bugs because they work well and people are using them in the wild. But yeah, some of those bugs were being used to own Android devices. And then, rather hilariously, the payload that they were dropping was actually like a ransomware kind of thing, except one of the like old school ransomware ones that instead of actually encrypting your files and demanding Bitcoin, this just threatens to – it says that it's the cyber police and that they're going to fine you unless you pay your fine – but that you're going to go to jail unless you pay your fine in iTunes gift cards, which being an Android user, clearly you have easy access
well,
to.
Well, I mean, I know when I get done for speeding, I always pay the police in iTunes gift cards, you know, sometimes Bitcoin, but, you know, iTunes gift card, currency of choice for my local authorities.
it's just depressing to see the, you know, the combination of what, you know, in the traditional hacker world are quite sweet exploits. I mean, going, like, getting a working, weaponized, smoothly running drive-by download engine. Like, I mean, there's quite a bit of work involved in that in terms of targeting and recon, and there's lots of moving parts that you have to get right. And you kind of feel the satisfaction of engineering a good, you know, a good solution.
So Adam is impressed with the criminals. Then,
well, I mean, at least that bit's competent, right? It's then you drop rubbish, useless, you know, cyber dot police apps on it that do a rubbish job of actually extorting money out of people. You'd think you would.
Hey, if it works, dude. If it works, it works.
Well, exactly, right? Yeah. It only has to be good enough to work. And that's the thing that offends the engineer in me. And the hacker in me that wants it to be, you know, shiny, well-polished, smooth, delicious, sweet, juicy, zero day.
Well, maybe, these guys will get pinched and you can laugh at them when they go to prison. And they better hope they're not in Georgia. Because in the United States, the creators of the SpyEye botnet creation kit have been sentenced to prison. One of them got a sentence of 9 years and 6 months, and the other got a sentence of 15 years in prison, which is, that's a pretty long time. Now, usually in the United States, people don't serve their full terms, but still, that's a pretty life-altering stretch.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And these guys were behind, you know, certainly one of the more popular financial crime-focused malware kits. I mean, SpyEye was one of the ones that kind of took over a bit from Zeus, although there was some cooperation or some... I think there was originally some beef and then some cooperation between the Zeus and the SpyEye guys. But, yeah, they've gone down for quite a long time. And I guess compared to, you know, what was that guy that gave out his Reuters creds or whatever it was?
Matthew Keyes,
That guy. Like, compared to that guy... It does seem, you know, maybe 15 years is a little bit light by comparison, you know, but on that metric, on that scale. But
well, that's under appeal. Way, like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you were on holiday, but I said, I think it was last week or the week before that, you know, Matthew Keyes should be doing community service, working in charity shops with old ladies who smell like dead skin. He should not be in prison.
Well, exactly. Whereas these guys pretty much probably do.
Yeah, they were unlucky though, man, because one of them, he was one of the ones that was black bagged in transit at Bangkok Airport in 2013. We spoke about that at the time, and it's just like, guys, really watch your flight routing. You know what I mean? Like, if you're doing this sort of shit, because you never, and that's the problem doing this sort of work, right? You don't know when they're onto you. And, you know, he's just sitting there going, hey, maybe I'll go to the smoking lounge, and then, hoik, black bagged, done.
Although actually, Krebs is running, the story that Krebs is running has a picture of the guy just after his arrest in Bangkok, and he's got a big old shit-eating grin on his face.
Certainly does. He looks like he's just seen an old friend or something. He's like, hey, what are you doing here? Oh, that's right, I'm going to prison. ThreatPost is carrying a story describing, looking at a POS attack, POS malware attack, that netted something like 20 million stolen bank cards.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty good call. I mean, the write-up asserts that there is a real pickup in attacks on POS systems as America is moving towards chip and PIN. So there's kind of like a last-minute gold rush to try and mine out all of the mag swipe POS systems, you know, whilst you still can. 20 million cards is good money. I mean, whether you're going to actually still manage to get, well, like $20 a card or whatever they're working on and make the $400 million that are quoted in the article for your 20 million cards, I don't know. That's... Yeah, you might struggle to monetize it quite that well. But yeah, any percentage of 400 million is still pretty good money for compromising, what was it, like 2,000 point of sale systems. So that's good ROI.
Yeah, FireEye's got a write-up on that he's linked to from the ThreatPost piece in this week's notes. oh, someone's created a decryptor for a type of ransomware. I mean, you see these things pop up every now and then when someone writes rubbish ransomware, someone will figure out a decryptor. This is the Crypt XXX variant. So if that has owned someone you know, instead of paying in Bitcoin, you can actually unlock it. So that's nice. Tesla Crypt has apparently, been repackaged with new file extensions. It's new, it's improved, it's getting better at AV evasion. That is also carried by ThreatPost. So you can go check that out in this week's notes. Now I want to move on to a blog post by Cloudflare, which is probably the most, one of the most awesome things. Like what I've noticed in 2015, 2016, it's the birth of the crime type where you just ask people for money and they give it to you. Whether that's impersonating the CFO or, you know, whatever it is, right? You just say, hey, can you please give me $500,000? Okay, thanks, bye. My favorite here from Cloudflare is that there's a group of people impersonating a DDoS crew called Armada Collective who turn up, email an admin and just go, hey, if you don't give us money, we're going to DDoS the shit out of you. And people pay. So, and these guys have taken down like 100K US. And I'm just like, oh man, why am I not doing this?
I know, right? I'm f***ing morals and ethics. God damn it.
Yeah, but I mean, you could target unethical people. You could target organizations that you don't like and shake them down for cash for nothing. Like online casinos, you know, that sort of thing.
That's a business model. We should get some VC funding.
Yeah, exactly. Why not? But no, all of their other funding is f***ed up on them. Why? I think this would be a good investment for a for an out of the box fund.
No, but the funny thing about this particular one, of course, is that the Armada Collective were going around doing DDoS for ransom a while ago, and were
So people Google them and go, "Who's the Armada Collective?" and then go, "Oh shit, these guys are badass." Like you and me could start emailing people and telling them we're DD4BC, and just sit there and watch the old bitcoins rolling in.
Oh dear. And you've left the country with all your ill-gotten wealth. They're onto you, buddy.
I haven't checked our extradition arrangements with Brazil, to be honest, but anyway. Might want to look into that. Make some fat cash. There's an interesting Windows app locker bypass that ThreatPost is reporting on. This is a, like, you know, the command line utility reg server 32, which is used to register DLLs. You can do some fancy, you know, footwork with DLLs and bypass app locker, which is kind of cool.
It's a really cool technique, actually. It's one of those ones that's really cool because it's not a bug.
It's a feature and it's generic, right? It's a generic bypass.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's super useful. Like I pasted that into Work IRC as soon as I saw it go past on Twitter and like, yes, we should do this. This is super useful. And yeah, it's a very sweet technique. Essentially, there's a piece of, you can configure Reg Server to run a piece of hook code on either registering or unregistering a DLL via Reg Server 32, and that the unregistering part doesn't require admin privilege, and so it just runs. Essentially, you can pull in a script, have Reg Server run it on your behalf because Reg Server is whitelisted by the app locker, or the whitelisting. It will just go ahead and run it. So it's a really cool way to bypass those kind of restrictions, which is, yeah, super useful as an attacker, also as a pen tester, I guess.
Moving on, and apparently now 1 million people now access Facebook over Tor Hidden Services every month. I don't know if you saw this, but yesterday, like, I kind of asked Alec Muffet, why? You know, why would you use, I mean, aside from the obvious, which is dodging censorship, which you can do without a hidden service anyway, right? Aside from that, why would you use Tor to connect to an identity service? And funnily enough, Alec is the guy who's responsible for this project, and he's basically turned around to me and gone, I don't know, man. Ask them. You know?
They should put a survey, because people on Facebook love surveys, right? They should put a survey and ask them why they're using Tor hidden service other than that it's cool. I can't think of a particular reason why you'd want to do it either. I suppose it means you have less need to trust an exit node.
But that's good when you're dodging anyway, right?
I mean,
when you're dodging censorship, I get that. But I'm asking, like, aside from that, because I guarantee you, like, at least 80% of these people are in the United States, right? Why? And I'm guessing it's because they're just like real ragers. You know what I mean? Who want to connect to their horrible privacy-ruining identity service with a privacy tool because of their, you know, their rage against the man.
look, bless their cyberpunk hearts. Like, it,
yeah. Yeah, but I just love the response from Alec. Like, I don't know, man, ask them. I think he just said, you know, nothing on the internet makes sense. So, but yeah, I think it's cool. I think it's a really cool idea for people in, you know, regimes where they censor. I think that is a great idea. But, you know, and 1 million people, that's, I guess it's a drop in the bucket for when you're in the broader context of Facebook users. But still, it's an interesting thing. And I think into the future, I think that more and more people will start using things like onion services because there's no reason not to. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just a good technology. Now, Adam, when we first reported on the Rowhammer exploit, this is the ultra cool, you know, physics layer exploit where you can introduce controllable bit flipping in RAM by, you know, reading and writing to it in certain ways. You know, when we first reported on that, which it can't have been that long ago, it must have been maybe a year ago or something, we thought that's cool. It'll never get used in the wild. But, you know, there's been some recent research. This is the second bit of research I've seen, I think, where people are just making Rowhammer style bit flipping exploitation look almost usable.
Yeah, no, the Rowhammer class of bugs is really interesting, and an area that hasn't, like, I mean, lots of obscure bug classes like this, you know, they show up in a research paper, someone demos it, you know, in a lab environment, and then that's pretty much the end of it. They don't often evolve further onwards, but the Rowhammer example is very different in that it has absolutely been evolving, and there's been a bunch more work done by people into it, both in terms of being able to actually exploit it in the wild and also to establish its viability on, you know, beyond the DDR3 class of RAM, design of RAM that was initially targeted by it. So there's been some work. There was a JavaScript implementation of it, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, we'll spoke about that. Because,
The way that it was originally demonstrated required pretty low level and very controlled hardware access and very high, kind of high speeds. And being able to take those primitives that you need to build that and mapping them onto things that are available in higher level functionality through JavaScript or through, in the particular example that Ars Technica was reporting on, using glibc's memset routine to be able to do the same sort of thing, to push it out into the memory in the right way, is really interesting. But the thing that I suppose really stood out for me about Rowhammer was there was a presentation, I think we talked about it a month ago, by Halvar.
Yeah, we did.
Thomas Doolian from Google in to like an engineering meetup in Singapore where he went through the Google experience of Rowhammer and all the things, the work that they've done on it, and talked through how they exploit it. And that for me really made the difference of actually, you know, a concrete, you know, very believable, very usable way of actually weaponizing it. And that made it a lot more relevant. Like, that's certainly, if you're interested in this bug, is absolutely worth watching that particular talk. But yeah, Rowhammer is a thing that just really, really, you know, threatens the concept of virtualization as a whole. Anything where you can jump up through the hypervisor straight into the hardware is, you know, in the modern world of public cloud, we don't know whose hardware you're sharing with, certainly has the potential to be a real badass bug class if you can make it work for you.
And as for this research, Adam.
But I mean, this research is an example of the method by which you have to go through to exploit this, which is to find the low-level primitives you need exposed in high-level functionality. And obviously, having them in libc, in the, you know, standard Linux GNU libc, is a thing that makes a lot more ways available to you.
Yeah.
I mean, through file formats or that kind of thing, which is that's the news here.
But now that it's been sort of shown to be almost a workable technique, you can almost guarantee that as this research progresses, you're burning this bug class. Like, once countermeasures come in, you can guarantee you're burning it for some, like, pretty serious actors out there, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess if Halvar gets hit by a drone strike, then we'll know what's going on. but yeah, I would be interested. I guess when we do find out eventually whether or not this class has been used, you know, was being used in the Intel community before it turned up in the public body of knowledge, that will be really interesting.
It's one of those ones that it would be kind of hard to find. You know what I mean? That's the thing. So anyway, I just think this is really interesting that this has turned out to be kind of exploitable. Oh, here's my favorite news item for the week. My absolute favorite news item is someone was taking part in a Facebook bug bounty, and they found, you know, like, as is always the case with bug bounties, they found some piece of shit server that someone had forgotten about on, you know, publicly addressable space, and they messed around with it and they got into it, and they're like, oh, I'm not the first person to have actually popped this box.
Yeah, no, this guy was doing a bug bounty. He found some bit of Facebook that had a bunch of internal access services, some like file transfer appliances, some Oracle e-business, which I'd just like to say is an awful idea to put on the internet, and some, you know, kind of VPN stuff. Anyway, busting through a bug in the file transfer appliance. And yeah, sure enough, in the web root, whole bunch of PHP backdoors with dates going back, you know, sometime.
Quite some time.
I'm going to the pub. I may be sometime.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess some incident response was rolled that day at Facebook HQ. But yeah,
that guy should get double for his work, you know, like honestly, because it's like bug bounty, yes. Found a bug and discovered an incident. So well done.
And one of the usernames he found in there were some logs or some scripts that were being used. And one of the usernames they were looking for was Soggy Cat.
There you go.
I guess the soggy cat actor has been all up in Facebook's business.
All right, Adam, that is actually the end of this week's news segment. But do stick around because now we're going to move on to this week's feature topic and you will be staying with me for this. This week's Risky Business is the Metal Storm Hour of Power. And in this week's feature, of course, we are taking a look at SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication. Essentially, SWIFT is a global interbank financial messaging system, or as one Twitter follower described it to me, it's like SS7, but written by MBAs in BASIC. It is the SCADA of the finance world, if you prefer that terminology. Now, look, the following is a massive oversimplification, but here goes. This is how SWIFT works. If a customer of Bank A in, say, Australia wants to send a customer of Bank B in England some money, they tee up the transaction, then an operator at the bank or an automated system keys the transaction details into a SWIFT console, or it automatically goes into a SWIFT API or whatever, which, you know, usually these SWIFT consoles, they're some sort of crappy custom web app or an even crappier pile of enterprise Java shitware, or it's an automated pile of enterprise shitware. But either way, it goes off into the SWIFT box, the SWIFT gateway, and off it goes. Now, of course, there are all sorts of transfers flying about throughout the day. And basically what happens is at the end of the day, the banks tally up how much money they owe each other due to these transactions, and they adjust their settlement balances accordingly. So SWIFT isn't necessarily the way the banks transfer the dollars, but it tells the banks where the dollars are going once they arrive at an institution. So in other words, the final settlement is actually done separately. But SWIFT is probably the most vital part of the process. If you can control a bank's SWIFT terminals, you can start sending money wherever you want. And if your victim doesn't catch it at settlement time, your work is basically done. Now, this is what the attackers behind the attack against Bangladesh's central bank did back in March. You would have heard about this story. In March, reports surfaced that someone had owned up the bank's network and keyed in a billion US dollars worth of transfers via SWIFT. Now, about $100 million of these transfers went through before someone noticed a spelling mistake in one of the wire orders and did a bit of digging. In the end, Bangladesh got most of the money back, and what hasn't been returned is mostly frozen in the Philippines. But what if the attackers didn't get greedy? What if they only wired a few million? They'd probably be home and hosed. And what if they did this over a few weeks to multiple institutions? You're looking at a pretty good payday and a hell of an incentive to get good at these types of attacks. Now, as I say, this story about Bangladesh broke in March, but a couple of things have happened over the last week or so. Firstly, outlets started reporting that, oh my god, the Bangladesh Central Bank didn't have a firewall and were using $10 dumb switches on their LAN, which actually isn't really a surprise when you think about it. There are plenty of insecure environments out there, particularly in countries that can't afford to spend 20% of their GDP on performance bonuses for their prima donna InfoSec teams. No offense to prima donna InfoSec teams that are listening. So that news I didn't find amazing. But then we saw a blog post out of BAE that suggests these attackers really do have their shit together. Apparently they used custom malware to delete fraudulent transfers from the SWIFT system's local Oracle database, as well as blocking confirmation printouts. Now I've linked to the write-up of that research in this week's show notes, so do go read it. It is impressive. And it seems that the attackers know the SWIFT software and indeed the SWIFT workflow completely, like back to front. So, yeah, as for that $10 switch thing, the oh my god, $10 switches, you know, a group of people capable of writing this sort of malware and who know Swift well enough to actually send correctly formatted messages, which I'm told is very difficult, well, they might be able to gain access to better protected environments as well. So, as I say, I think this $10 switch and no firewall thing is basically a red herring. But indeed, this is not all we learned this week. Thanks to some excellent reporting by Reuters, we know that Swift sent out a customer memo on Monday urging its users to install a series of patches. But what made that a very interesting memo is it referred to multiple cyber incidents. So, Bangladesh apparently isn't the only victim. Attackers are now going after Swift infrastructure at multiple institutions. One group or more? We have no idea. Now, I know this is the world's longest introduction to a segment, but let me keep going here for just a minute, because there's something about Swift that makes it just super cute. Here's its security model in a nutshell. It's a private network. That's right, Swift was designed in the days where you couldn't trust the internet, but everyone assumed your endpoints would be okay. And that's the assumption that underpins the global system that sends money everywhere. And this makes me remember an interview I did back in 2008 with Dan Gear, who's currently the Chief Security Officer at InQtel. At the time, there was a lot of news kicking around about how a substantial chunk of the world's Windows boxes were owned. Here's what he said back on Risky Business, episode 83.
Network security says, I'm okay, you're okay, and the internet is a problem. Suppose 30% of all desktop machines are already owned by somebody else. If that's the case, the basic premise of network security is no longer valid, because it isn't I'm okay, you're okay. It's I'm okay, I think. I have to assume you're owned, and the internet may make this worse. Now, that is a very different kind of environment.
Now, sure, infection rates might not be at 30% these days, but the fact infection rates are an actual metric measured in non-trivial percentages within every enterprise with a security team means Dan's point is still valid. Private networks basically don't get you anywhere anymore if they're also connected to the internet via workstations, especially workstations that run your custom enterprise Java shitware for interfacing with your Swift gateways. In other words, if you own any workstation that has Swift access, you can wire transfers from that bank to whoever you want, especially if you've got some malware that can hide those transfers locally. Of course, the good news here is that real life isn't like Swordfish. If you transfer $1 billion out of an account, you know, people are going to notice, and it's not going to be terribly hard to reverse that transaction. That's what happened in this instance. But what about $500,000? $1 million? $2 million? What about transaction amounts that are routine? Can you exfil that sort of money in the time it takes for a bank to discover the fraud? My guess is you can. Adam, what's your take on this? This malware that BAE looked at is pretty badass, don't you think? I mean, this, in my mind, this sequence of events is a bit of a game changer for financial institutions.
Yeah, I think this should be a real wake-up call for them, because if there's one thing that I took away from reading the BAE write-up, it's that these guys know this platform. They know how it works. They've got the necessary tooling to do it. And you don't develop that in a vacuum, right? You develop that because you need it. And you develop it in the wild, or with the experience of someone who has worked on these systems, you know, by working at a bank, or by working on the software that these systems use, you know, for their work. Like, these are people who are, you know, essentially professionals at this aspect of it. And as you say, it's a private network, and that's the security model, but it's also a private body of knowledge, right, of how this system works in much the same way that SS7 or SCADA or, you know, the international travel booking system, any one of those kind of legacy closed networks where not only physical access to the terminals or the network, but also access to the knowledge about those systems are what has, you know, made them function well.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because something that the first thing that came to my mind was the travel stuff. Do you know what I mean? You've seen the travel agent sitting there like plugging away at one of these terminals, and you know, that's kind of what Swift is. There are some various front ends. You know, and a lot of institutions organize things so that when there is a large transfer, a few people have to sort of sign it off with their creds. But, you know, okay, taking over a workstation is one thing, but if you take over the actual gateway, you can do basically whatever the hell you want. I mean, I'm sure there are some organizations that are doing some fun stuff with HSMs. In fact, I know there are, but they're not the majority, right? People are a little bit, from the research I've done this week, it seems like people are a little bit YOLO-sec with their Swift stuff.
I would absolutely believe that, yes, because I think most people rely on, you know, you have a set of business rules, and those business rules might be you have to have, you know, two person sign off on transfers over a certain amount or whatever. But those business rules are just implemented by the same software stack, right? I mean, they're implemented by some Oracle thing or some SAP thing or, you know, whatever.
I believe enterprise. The correct terminology is Java shitware.
Enterprise Java shitware. They're implemented
That's
by
the
that.
One.
And hot patching enterprise Java shitware is straightforward. Mm. And in this particular case, the malware in question hot patches one of the Oracle DLLs in memory to remove some particular check, as well as having some code in place to actually monitor the Swift transfers and then edit the edit the logs, edit the print jobs, as you said in the intro, which all these rules are just implemented by software, and that software is in no way better controlled or more reliable or integrity checked or anything like that. I mean, it's installed once, 15 years ago by some consultants and then never looked at ever again as long as it continues to work.
Well, and let's not forget that in web application installations of this stuff, it's really easy to roll man in browser, just own up a couple of workstations, figure out who countersigns for who. And, Robert's your mother's brother. I'm amazed it's taken until now for this to surface as a, I'm sure there's been attacks like this in the past that we haven't heard about, but I kind of feel like I've heard the sound of a starter's pistol firing. Does it feel like that to you as well?
Well, I think once you get the idea that somebody else is doing it, and succeeding clearly, and making the kind of money that they're talking about. I mean, even the 20 million or whatever it is that hasn't been successfully seized in the Philippines, the stuff that actually made it offshore, out into a casino in Macau and then onwards to China, which is apparently where the money chain went. But there was some like ferry boat captain from China had been paid to open a bank account in the Philippines.
Yeah, no, I think I'm unclear as to what actually happened to that 20 mil, but I don't think that really matters. Like, as I said in the intro, like, what if they just took half a mil, a mil, or 2 mil, right? Like, instead of trying to grab $1 billion, like, I think if they hadn't have been so greedy, they would have got away easy clear with like 30 or 40 mil.
Well, and I think the thing is, you don't steal $1 billion the first time you do it, right? You steal $1 billion because you've done it enough times that you're confident.
Yeah.
And the information we saw from the Swift group that Reuters was reporting on suggesting multiple incidents in other places. And there was some talk of like about 400 million being transferred in the UK at a bank as well. That they managed to, track down through the same sort of mechanism of catching it during the settlement phase. But you don't go straight to the billion the first time you do it. You test it with, $100,000, $50,000, whatever amount works. And those must have worked for you to get to the point where you're confident enough to blow, to do the $900 million worth. So clearly this stuff does absolutely work already.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think it could go either way. I think either you just think I'm going to go hard or go home, or as you say, like, you've done it a bunch of times and you're comfortable and you want to see how far you push it. But the thing that I find most fascinating about this story, now SCADA, right, the thing that has stopped industrial control systems from exploding is that no one is really motivated to make that happen. State-sponsored actors don't want to do it because they don't want, because attribution isn't as hard as some people would make you think it is, and they don't want to get into a hot war because of stuff they've done over the internet. And thankfully, some of these non-state groups like ISIL, they don't have the expertise yet. But here we've got a system that for all intents and purposes looks to be about as flaky as your average ICS or SS7, but the motivation to attack it is about as big as it gets, right? So what do you do if you're a financial institution? You obviously can't separate the workstations that have access to the Swift API or gateway or whatever. You can't just take them off the internet. So what do you do without fixing security,
Well, I mean, I guess I would argue that maybe you have to fix security. I mean, I think, and the reporting around the $10 secondhand switches and the lack or the rubbish firewalls that are in place, I think is really indicative of the problem, right? I mean, the fact that we are laughing at them for not having, pairs of $600,000 high availability checkpoints, when we all know that that would actually have made zero difference, right? If you're on the Swift terminal, then the firewall is going to permit traffic from the Swift terminal to the gateway, and like it's going to be permitted by any security control you've put in place, because your controls aren't reflective of the attack that is being persecuted against you. And I think the fact that we're laughing about that is exactly the kind of the problem there, that we do actually have
to
address.
Well, Adam, that's actually what I was getting at there.
Well yeah, exactly.
That, everyone can point at them and laugh about their, they can laugh about their, terrible security. But the fact is, you're talking about a group of people who know these systems very well, who obviously know these systems very well. They're writing custom malware, you know, do you think they couldn't have done what Phineas Fisher has done and maybe own some previously, you know, some embedded device that a bank with a massive security budget didn't quite realize was on publicly addressable space? Do you know what I mean? Like, this is a group of attackers who clearly know their shit, and they were just trying to scoop $1 billion out of Bangladesh, because why not? But I wouldn't be feeling too complacent if I was the CSO at a bank. I mean, do you think this is an incident that justifies people in financial institutions who do have good security programs taking a good, cold, hard look at the parts of their environment that do have access to their SWIFT gateways?
Absolutely, I do, yes. I mean, the traditional security controls, you know, of segmentation and firewalls and that kind of thing really aren't relevant to this class of attack. I mean, once you're in a position to carry out this attack and you get there through, you know, all sorts of mechanisms that are already well understood and aren't well controlled by the security processes that we have in place, once you're in a position to do them, then generally there is very little after that, because these systems are largely opaque to the security team. If you go and talk to the security team at a bank these days and you say, how does your enterprise message bus work? Who can put stuff on and off the MQ? What authorization is there per task endpoint on the MQ? What audit logs do you have of who put stuff on and off the MQ? You know, that kind of thing. But most of them will actually have no visibility of how it works, because they're so busy. They're so bogged down focusing on the traditional security controls, you know, AV and patching and stuff that, you know, are good for mass market threats, but really aren't the thing that target attackers like this are going to go and worry about. And if you ask people, you know, exactly what they're going to do about it, they'll ask how many banks have suffered, you know, even insider fraud, where people who work there understand how the message queuing system works and can put transfers on and off even internal to the bank, not even on the SWIFT side of things, then I think you will find that most people are not equipped to answer that question. And if you can't answer that question internally, then you've got to wonder whether you're going to spot it on the outside interfaces through SWIFT or whatever other mechanisms.
I spoke to a pen tester based in London who's done a few pen tests on you know, internal pen tests on their SWIFT stuff. And, you know, it's either always Java shitware, you know, through horrible out-of-date browsers, or it's a web application that is riddled with, like, cross-site request forgery bugs. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the state. That's the level at which even these respected financial institutions in London are operating at. And it just makes you think, well, firstly, no wonder the Bangladeshis didn't have a hope in hell of fending this off. But it also makes me think, well, you know, everyone is laughing at them. I don't know, man. You're not exactly sitting safe.
No, I would say that the attackers that perpetrated this particular attack in Bangladesh are capable of doing it against any bank.
Yeah. Right?
First world, third world, wherever you happen to be. I don't think anyone is equipped to defend against real targeted, well-funded. I mean, if you've got a, you know, 10 million, 20 million, whatever on the bank from, you know, a few earlier rounds of this, you are very well equipped to do this.
Yeah.
To do this anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think it would work anywhere. You just got to be, you know, a little more focused, like not make spelling mistakes in the destination of your funds transfer. And, you know, not screw up and you get away with it. And clearly people are getting away with it. And we've seen that payroll card fraud one, where they were cashing out from ATMs and altering the bank balances or the withdrawal permit, like the amounts permitted to be withdrawn on ATM cards in real time and monitoring the transactions in real time. That demonstrated a really thorough understanding of the bank systems in question and also how to clean up the audit logs. And as far as I'm aware, that particular crew did get away with it. We haven't seen anyone go down for that.
Well,
so,
I mean,
the stuff.
I remember we've seen, you know, some in that type of fraud that you're talking about. You know, the way that these guys do it is they drop screen recording software onto the bank workstations. But this one, I don't think that's what's happened. And I've spoken to a few people about that, and they agree. Because really, you're talking about someone who's actually managed to write malware that demonstrates a really solid knowledge of the SWIFT software itself, right? So this isn't just someone who's run screen capture, a screen record, and watch the way people wire shit around. This is someone who intimately understands SWIFT. I mean, this is obviously someone who's admin SWIFT stuff before, right?
That is certainly probably the most likely scenario.
Because I mean, you can't just download this stuff off the internet, right?
Well, no, but I mean, we the hacker community have a long history of you know, reverse engineering these systems once we get some access to them and then learning how they work. I mean, I've implemented financial protocol transaction stacks myself in Python when I needed them on a job. It's not a pleasant way to spend a week or two, but I mean, it's, you know, it's in the order of a week or two's work for like in my case, right, I had never worked on that particular type of transaction processing system, and it was a couple of weeks of Python, right? And I got to the stage where I could talk to the payment gateways, submit transactions, get responses back, man in the middle existing connections, you know, without really having a deep background knowledge, never having worked in a bank. So I mean,
so it's doable. You know,
it's not.
It's doable. Now look,
it is doable. Yes.
Just speaking of those engagements, right? You've obviously been exposed to networks that have access to Swift gear. What did they? How did they come up? How did they look?
Well, I mean, I think in general, I speak in very general terms, obviously, but in general, for most people, their security controls don't do what they think that they do. And regardless of whether the environment has a bunch of security controls or not, those controls don't provide the level of assurance that you think that they do. And when you've got a line in your risk register that says, you know, attacker might use access to the desktop network to gain access to the Swift transaction processing network, and that threat is mitigated by control X, Y, and Z. In most people's cases, those controls don't actually mitigate it, and the people who are defending don't have the same problems as attackers. They don't have to think like attackers, and so of course we find more creative ways to get around those controls. So in almost all cases, they are not effective in the big picture, and I think that's true in most environments. You know, whether they're transaction processing or you know, or they handle very sensitive ID data or network data or whatever it happens to be, because, you know, people don't actually try and break them. So they don't understand how they break. And, you know, that's true whether you're spending $10 on a D-Link or, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on high-end Cisco gear.
The funny thing about this one is, you know, it's come out into the public domain, but I have a feeling that even if this has been going on for some time, we would not know about it because banks typically don't like talking about this sort of stuff. But hard to ignore when it's $1 billion, right? Which is maybe why we know about it.
Well, exactly right. You can wear $10, $20, $100 million worth of fraud because the cost to you in you know, sort of reputation damage or customer confidence, you know, to talk about it is much more than that. But once you're getting up into the $1 billion, especially in the case of Bangladesh, where apparently the financial foreign currency reserves of the Bank of Bangladesh were in the order of $27 billion. So this is a significant portion of their holdings, had it successfully been transferred. Like that, you can't just sweep under the rug as a cost of doing business, which is, you know, what we see with, you know, the other sorts of fraud in banks that we don't hear about.
I suspect the cost of doing business is about to appreciate somewhat, hence this segment. But Adam, we're going to have to leave it there, mate. But thanks for doing the whole show with me. It's been a lot of fun. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back in the saddle. You know, a couple of weeks of looking at trees and I am well ready to hack stuff.
Excellent. Well, we'll be back next week with more information security news and current affairs. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. He's been Adam Boileau. Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much, everybody.